Brainstorm Brewery is brought to you by GatheringMagic.com and CoolStuffInc.com. Show your support. Welcome, everyone, to another special episode of Brainstorm Brewery. There we go. I got it right this time.
Emphasis on special, apparently, this time.
But then you messed it up by saying that you got it right. Yeah.
Yeah, now everyone knows you screwed up. But how many takes did he screw up, everyone? You don't know.
You have to listen to the after hours to find that one out whenever we do release an after hours. Okay.
We've created plenty of after hours content the past few weeks. I know that.
Yeah, just like this hour and a half or hour 15-minute conversation before we actually recorded this podcast.
Yeah,
no, everyone was late. Come on. It's only been
this is why you don't record a podcast with people you're friends with.
I was watching 21 Jump Street, all right?
Or would you admit
I was finishing the last of the slow bleeding league game, which was awful.
And I was watching Attack on Titans, getting sucked into the vortex.
Oh, it's so good.
You guys at home, if we get the after hours out, you'll hear about Attack on Titan or whatever it's called. It's apparently very scary for a cartoon.
It's surreal. That's the good way to put it.
Yeah, it's because it's a cartoon.
Oh man,
your mom's a cartoon.
Actually, Jason, you're a cartoon. You're a cartoon stag with a bottle facing me right now.
That's true. That is what your picture says.
Yep, and he's threatening somebody with a bottle, and I wanted to threaten someone with a bottle today.
Segway.
Boom. Executed perfectly.
All right, all right. Let's
talk about it. Okay, so.
I give that segway a B+.
Ah, well, okay. It's still a passing grade. Bs get degrees. Okay, so a guy called me last night.
But I think you could probably do better the next time that you...
This is what I do to you.
This is Marcel counter-trolling here.
I like the irony of this, because usually this is Jason doing this to Marcel.
This is what I do to you. This is not what is done to me.
I think everyone listening at home probably is just angry regardless, so doesn't matter which one of you is trolling the other.
Only four people on Earth are getting a kick out of this. Okay. Guy called me last night. Is that okay with you, Marcel?
Marcel, is it okay that a guy called him? Is that okay with you?
I don't ask, I don't tell.
After the phone sex, he said he had a collection for me, that he found out.
A collection of what?
Collections. You guys are really, I'm hearing you in my headphones, I'm not hearing what you're saying. So
oh my god, just finish this story.
Let's go. You got full,
You guys are jacking me up. Alright, long story short, because I'm out of time now. Guy calls me, he says, hey, I found out that you buy collections, I'm looking to sell my collection, I've got Alpha stuff. And I was like, oh, I'm real interested in Alpha stuff. So I went to check it out.
What kind of Alpha stuff? It's better than that, right?
That's a good question.
Yeah, well, he's like, I've got Alpha Counterspells and Alpha Dark Rituals and Alpha Control Magics. And I'm like, wow, an Alpha Counterspell is like $90. And the best part is it buy lists for 70. So if I can get this collection for decent, I can make money just flipping this to a buy list that I don't have to find a buyer for a $95 Alpha Counterspell. So I was like, I'm very interested. So I went to check out the collection and
did he have any lands in there or anything like that?
Yeah, lots of Alpha Basics. And, you know, I've got that Mark Pool Island, the bluish green one that looks like the background of Birds of Paradise. That's my favorite. I was hoping he had some Alpha Mark Pool Islands for me.
I thought there was something for $200 land though.
Yeah, there's a $200 land in the collection also.
That's
less important than all the Alpha stuff that I was like mentally spending all this money already.
Because even basic lands from Alpha are worth money, right?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Like $5-6 a piece minimum. So, it's like $2-3 on the buy list. Easy. So, I went to look at the Alpha stuff and the Alpha cards had beta corners.
Oh no.
And white borders. They were revised cards.
Oh,
they're kind of the same. They're kind of the same.
That $90 counterspell was a 70-cent revised counterspell. So, how much money should you take when you go to buy a collection? I don't know. because you can't always believe what people say when they call you on the phone. This is actually the second time somebody told me they had alpha stuff and it was revised. So
it's never alpha stuff. Like I always assume going in, it's never alpha stuff.
He said it's funny. Everyone who's played in 93 says they have alpha stuff. And they'll be like, I've been playing our game since.
And people tell you their cards are from 1993 because that's what it says at the bottom of each card now.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I actually had the – I had somebody tell me they had beta one time. It turned out to be alpha. I would – once in my life, I've been on, like, the right side of that mistake.
I wish I wish I had been on the right side of the
I've
mistake.
Been
so
there.
It wasn't
just
a total
like,
waste of time, but I did end up passing on the collection. The $200 land was actually an MP flooded strand. So,
maybe $40 on a buy list. Maybe.
Yeah. So – I didn't have my day ruined. I used that opportunity to stock the case. And that is just another reason why it is good to have the arrangement I have with the store. They weren't selling singles. I was like, hey, could I rent a case from you and sell my singles? So he gets a percentage of all my single sales. And anybody that brings in a collection to sell to the store, he doesn't do that. So he gives them my number. And a lot of times they'll call me and I'll get a lot of collections that way that I wouldn't just as a person. Because a guy sitting at home, they don't know I'm buying collections, but they will go into a store with the cards and say, hey, I'm selling. So that's been it's been really profitable for me, and it's been a good symbiotic relationship I have with the store because he was underutilizing the case space and, you know, not having people come in to buy Magic singles. And the EDH crowd in the city where I live really likes that case, so I just blow through Planeswalkers and EDH staples like, whoa. So it's been a good relationship, but – occasionally someone will call you, and it's never alpha.
Yeah, so do you think that anyone that would say it's alpha and actually knew that it was alpha would actually probably just buy a list of cards?
They wouldn't. No, they can sell – you can find them in collections, but those people who know it's alpha will send you pictures. And, like, we'll be telling you because, like, if you're like, okay, what's the condition? They're not just going to be like, it's in pretty good shape. Like, if they know they have alpha cards, they know they have to send you pictures. And that until you get pictures, it's never alpha.
Yeah, I mean, people – generally, the more expensive cards people have, the more knowledgeable they are about them. I mean, the stories where, hey, somebody's mom found their collection of beta dual lands and sold them for $5, like, those stories get out there, and maybe they occasionally do happen, but for the most part –
they definitely do happen. I mean, it's just –
I know. I've seen it, but for the most part – yeah. For the most part, people know what they have if they have cards worth thousands of dollars.
Yeah. I mean, you get the guy usually who's, you know, had these cards in his closet for years and years and years. Like, I've still found – I mean, it's not that far of a stretch when you really think about it. Yeah, like, I find collections all the time where it's just, like, a bunch of Homelands cards. I think I played 2 or 3 years earlier. Like, that would have been the right time. So it's not that these people don't exist and these cards – like, you can't find them anymore and that people still think they know all their cards collect – or their value. It's just that – it's hard to find. There's not a lot of alpha and beta out there when you really start thinking about it. And the amount of people who bought into it and then didn't sell it at any point are still sitting on it obviously dwindles with each collection that sells.
Right. That's what I was going to say. Yeah, I mean, every time one of those stories comes about, and there's this chain store here that I've walked into and people have come to me where they've got beta lands out of them for a dime because somebody sold them to that store for bulk and that store didn't know and they sold them for bulk. Like, but every time that happens, there's one fewer – you know, unpicked collection of beta out there. So anyway, so
yeah, that
just...
store was sweet. It felt like playing the lottery. Like we just bought a bunch of bulk lots.
Yeah.
Yes. And we did terrible.
I've seen it pay off though. Like I've bought a lot of cards from people who've bought cards from there is the best way to put it because I don't have 8 hours to go look through their boxes and try to hit the lottery. Like I'm not going to go look through 50,000 cards on the off chance that, you know, that week somebody brought in a beta basic or beta collection and it hasn't been picked by somebody already. But anyways, it has happened.
See, I don't see what the big deal with beta is. It's just a bunch of corset cards with a black border. Like, does that make anything different?
I smell a segue.
It's the same reason, you know.
Could it be a segue to talking about the corset Magic 2015?
Or
the corset is our Finance 101?
Yes, Finance 101 this week. Talking about how corsets are different from expansion sets.
And how corsets themselves have changed over the past couple of years.
Corsets or bodices were worn by women in the 18th century. No,
yeah. Sorry. Good try. So basically the corsets, you know, revised through 10th edition, they were just reprints. They were a collection of cards reprinted. And basically the idea was, hey, if somebody didn't play, you know, a year and a half ago to get these cards, we're going to print Wrath of God in a core set so that somebody can find them. It basically was a way to increase card supply. But, you know, the downside of that is, you know, 15 years in, basically nobody cared about core sets at all. If people had their cards, nobody was – the core sets weren't exciting. They were just a random collection of reprints that didn't necessarily play well together. So they made the big change after 10th edition. They made Magic 2010, which came out in the summer of 2009. And that's how we got into the, you know, the modern age of core sets where they have their own new cards in them that are typically not tied to any one – certain, you know, mechanic. Like, they're not enchantment focused like everything in Theros was. They're just top down cards that make sense within themselves, and they bring back a mechanic from you know, another set. They just return a mechanic that people liked, and they develop them much more for limited play. So that's the new core set that came around in M10, and they had things like Baneslayer Angel just kind of heralding the new age. So it proved to be much more popular and kind of has been a big deal. You know, the last couple of years, maybe it's tailed off a little, maybe not. But core sets are still a very, very long way from where they used to be. So the important thing, though, is that during the summer, people are going to the lake. They're doing whatever, you know, they're enjoying their summer. So while new players do get into the core sets, the players who are more advanced and enfranchised aren't necessarily, you know, just tearing these things open. And the fact that they're only open for a couple months until the new set comes out means that over the course of their lifetime in Standard, which is basically 15 months, the prices tend to stay higher. So a card in something that was in Theros and is $5 is more likely to be, you know, $8, $9 out of a core set. That's how we've had – you know, that's how we had $50 Baneslayer Angels, $50 Primeval Titans, and even stuff like $15, $20 Phantasmal Images during their time in Standard. Just things
that was
don't...
despite being in a dual deck.
Right. So, yeah, I mean, so that's basically the gist of it. So the question is, you know, for you guys, and explain to people, how do you approach, as both a player or, you know, somebody interested in finance, you know, the core set cards?
I mean, I think you have to kind of look at the core set as a whole, much more than you do a normal set. Like a normal set, yeah, it matters how many other good cards there are in it, but because it's a theme, there's going to be enough cards to be playable. Like they have to make sure that, you know, Standard has reasonable cards in it. The core set, because a lot of times it's a lot more, is like a supportive set. If there's only a couple of cards out of it that are going to be good, especially at the Mythic Rare, those cards are going to be much, much more expensive. I mean, you look at things like Thundermaw Hellkite. I mean, you use Baneslayer Angel, I believe, as an example. That's much more relevant, and I think the also on the other end of that, the rares that are more towards the casual driven that come out of those core sets, especially ones that are reprinted, are going to tank really hard because the people that are buying those sets are the people who want those cards. And you're having like the way to look at it is like the competitive cards that you know, that crowd that you were talking about is spending that summer off. They're not getting those cards, and those are the cards that become worth a lot of money typically. Rarely do the casual cards hold much value until 6-8 months down the road once they've started drying up a little bit.
Right. Yeah, I think long-term, those casual cards do really well. You know, look at something like Captivating Vampire. You know, it's just kind of a random vampire lord that was actually even in, I believe, an intro deck, but it's still worth $4 or $5.
Standard play at the time, though, so it helped his price right off the bat.
Right. Well, it's $4 or $5 now is what I'm saying. So the casual cards hold up over time, but you're right that they drop harder at first.
Yeah, especially the reprints. That's something – like if you see a competitive reprint, it's typically not going to drop nearly as hard. Look at something like Chandra's Phoenix. It actually went up after being reprinted just because it was legal and standard, as opposed to something like Door to Destinies that, you know, tanked.
And there's long-term financial opportunity in this stuff now because people will stop to care about core set stuff. And picking it up at rotation is just silly. Like, if you look at a Captivating Vampire right now, it's like $2 less than the foil. And that tells me that there's, like, so much demand for the card that...
The foil was in the intro deck.
Yeah, it was an intro deck, and also casual foils are usually just lower than competitive foils percentage-wise.
Well, no, but, like, not the fact that the foil's down, but the fact that the non-foil's up. Like, it tells me there's a lot of demand for just the cheapest version of the card because people are playing with it.
Yeah, I mean, it's I don't know. I really, especially this core set, I am very excited about it. It feels like they have enough powerful cards for constructed. They've got insane casual cards in it as well. I mean, this core set's shaping up to be really nice. But so probably one other thing to keep in mind about core sets is that they're not in standard for as long as other sets. They actually have the shortest lifespan in standard of any set because they rotate, like I said, every 15 months. So M14 will rotate in October. So for the next 3 months, we'll have M15 and M14 both available. But M14, which just came out last summer, will be gone in a few months.
Yeah, and it's also the same reason that you see the last set of a block also do similar price-wise, just because you're doing the same thing in the summer. The difference is really the limited format sped up a lot with the core sets because it's not played for as long. But it spends about the same amount of time in standard, if I'm not mistaken.
It used to be, what, 2 years before they actually switched over to the M's?
Yeah,
but like,
yeah.
If you think about it, like, Journey into Nyx isn't going to have a full 2 years.
It's 18 have, months.
Like, I see what you're saying.
18 months?
Yeah, it's 18. I mean, it comes out 3 months before and 15. So, yeah, it's 18 months.
Oh, true story. Okay, fair enough.
But, yeah.
But, yeah, I mean,
but the cool part of it,
it's the same reason you see all these cards from Theros are so much cheaper on average than the cards from the core set from last year. I mean, clearly rotation's doing a little bit of weird things with prices, but, yeah. Overall, it's a pretty good rule of thumb.
The cool thing about the overlap is that you're able to release cards in, say, the M15 set that can play with all the cards in the previous sets and including M14. Like, one of the preview cards that they released this week was the Sliver Hide Lord, which is a Wooburg, which is all five colors for a 5/5 legendary Sliver. Sliver creatures you control have indestructible. So this is
insane.
This is nuts, but this is great because it's only going to be in standard for these 3 months, and they engineered it as such. And, you know, this is really cool that they're able to do this with the core sets and really kind of mold these standard formats and such.
I think there's going to be a cycle of slivers at Uncommon also that they're talking about doing. So they've spoiled Constricting Sliver, and I don't think we've seen any of the other ones. So those six slivers we're going to have, plus the ones from the last set, plus the Sliver Hive. So, yeah, that's something they're doing, kind of bridging the two core sets together and giving us fun stuff. That's something new they started doing recently.
I mean, Constricting Sliver is just a house of its own. I mean, you get a Banishing Priest out of every one of your slivers.
Well, I think I think the reason they're giving us more slivers this time around is because of how poorly received they were last time. So now those people who tried to make sliver decks and just didn't have enough cards can try to get there a little bit. Plus, you know, they give us the new mythic one, which is absolutely insane for basically every sliver deck played in casual or commander. And they change the art back to what people like on them. They definitely trying to make up on it.
They know it was supposed to be a 7/7. So they tested it at 7/7, and apparently the sliver deck was too good. Why else would they make it a 5/5? So... Seriously, like,
explain to people why it should be a 7/7.
Sliver Queen, Sliver Overlord, and Sliver Legion are all 7/7s for Wooburg, as Marcel said, because apparently that's a thing, calling them Woobergs.
It is.
They're all Woobergs, they're all 7/7s.
It's a color.
I think the issue with that is, like, the mana base is potentially there to put a 5-color deck together, and putting a 7/7 indestructible isn't, like, great. I mean, that actually could be too good by itself. I don't think it's necessarily an issue, but it's certainly something they probably thought about within the standard environment, especially if other slivers are actually playable. I mean, you have 3 months where you still have to have a format that's playable.
Okay, so Sliver Hive Lord, you know, I know we're going to do the full set review in a while, a couple weeks, so there's probably next week. So there's not a reason to necessarily go too deep, but this is basically like casual/commander gold, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
Also, you spent about 30 seconds talking about how you're not going to talk about this for too long.
Yeah, I stumbled over my words. Calm down.
He's got to take the opportunity. It's Jason.
But yeah, I haven't seen what this thing is reselling at, but it's going to be cheaper, and then it will be all the money like 2 years from now.
I bet foils of these are priced properly. Sites like Star City are really good at noticing when stuff should be the right foil price. They make some mistakes sometimes, but if you notice something like Young Pyromancer was very correctly priced right out of the gate. There was no opportunity there. Do you have a counter example?
Yeah, I mean the only question is if in a few months this Star City, for instance, does it even have a foil version priced out right now? But they're selling the non-foil 15.
15 seems
not terribly unreasonable.
I mean, right? my numbers, like my snap number in my gut was 25, but I think that's based on older, similar looking slivers with smaller sets. So right. 15 it's a good place to start. If they sell out of 15 very quickly, which I don't know that they will, because this card is not going to get bought four cards at a time. This is going to get bought one copy at a time, so that's going to calm it down a little bit. But I think this is something you just try to pack, because good luck trading for this. Something else they spoiled that I've been waiting for, if you notice, there was kind of a cycle that they were doing with the new Avacyn, the new Obnixilis. They had the blue guy that polymorphs, and then they had the green guy that's just, the world's worst birthing pod. They finally released a red one, and the red one is, like, I don't know why they waited forever, but the red one's really good.
It's whenever you activate an ability of an artifact, if it isn't the mana ability, you can pay one red to copy it. That seems pretty good.
That's just super easy. Like, there's already, like, Slowbad and, I guess, Godo and other red-based artifact decks for EDH. This guy could probably be a general. Or he definitely slots into the Slowbad deck. So there's lots of mono-red artifact combo decks in EDH, and this is just, like, another card that either gets built around or gets in that deck, and I'm really excited about this guy. And I think he'll probably be undervalued. I don't see Avacyn and Obnixilis being undervalued. I think out of the cycle, this guy is going to be the one that everyone's just kind of like, yeah, whatever. And you have an opportunity to pick this up.
So
cheap, I think.
I basically feel that way about the entire set. That's just me. This thing looks nuts. We have six Planeswalkers, probably, arguably the best Wooburg sliver ever printed. We have the Soul of Blank Cycle at Mythic, and then we have two artifacts that are certainly not, certainly not bad. Like, I don't see a Mythic in this set that I would be unhappy to open.
Hmm. I'm particularly happy about Perilous Vault. Like, that, I mean, I guess people say it's too expensive for standard, but I don't think so. This is a site. And then EDH potential, and then...
See, the problem is you're really jammed up at that mana slot in EDH. Like, do you want to play Coercive Portal? Or O-Stone, or this, or like...
Why would you
want to
play O-Stone over this? Like, O-Stone this is better than this.
No, yeah. Well, okay, so first of all, O-Stone is three mana, but also O-Stone can protect your own stuff, Marcel.
Yeah. Yeah. This Exiles, which is... I'm sure.
No, Exiles is definitely good, but the problem is, like, people were like, hey, do you want to run this in Tron? And I was like, does the guy with Wormcoil Engine want to run the thing that Exiles stuff? I don't know.
Yeah, like, that's actually how I would feel about that, too. I don't mind blowing all my stuff up with an O-Stone so I can get it back later, but I do mind exiling it.
Yeah, so
anyways,
like,
we went all Commander talk there.
Well, it's a financially relevant format.
Yeah.
See, that's what I get. I should play Commander, but I'm not going to, so
it's
I'll never
fun.
Know.
Yeah. Oh, I'm building a Commander deck for sure. And I think that's like part of the great thing about this set is like we were talking about, there's no real bad mythics, and even a bunch of the rares, like, they will probably be, most of these generals or whatever will not be worth a ton of money just because they'll be easy to open, they're rare, and, like, there's a lot of good cards in the set, so something has to cut the value, and that'll be it, is most of the casual stuff. But, like, Obnixilis, I'm building Marilyn the Mournsong because of that card, and I think, I don't know, it's been a while since I've been excited about a set like I have this one, like, all around as a set, not just a couple of cards in it.
Yeah, this is a set that I want singles out of 2 years from now. Basically,
yeah,
like,
absolutely.
I don't know what sealed product will do, but I know that all these mythics are just going to be insane.
Well, not only that, but it's also the first set that they're ever printing with this new border, which will by itself carry some value.
Hmm. Yeah. So let's talk about the card we discussed last week when we weren't sure if it was coming or not, but they went ahead and gave us a six Planeswalker that we didn't necessarily expect.
Ryan called it. Ryan was on it.
Yeah. Garrick, Apex Predator. 7 mana, black, green, 5 loyalty, +1, destroy another target Planeswalker, +1, put a 3/3 black beast token with death touch onto the battlefield, -3, destroy target creature, gain life equal to its toughness, -8, target opponent gets an emblem with whenever a creature attacks you, it gets +5/+5 and gets trample until end of turn. Okay, so let's start with what we know. We know that this card is really good. Just the power level is obviously nuts. Destroy another target planeswalker is text we've never seen. It makes it very good in Commander, as is making Death Touch tokens. It's sure to be casually popular. Do you guys think it has a shot in Standard?
Yes, I do. I think it's just so.
Unfortunately, because of Nissa, I do. Like, I think there is like a green black rock deck with like Thoughtseize, Hero's Downfall, some amount of Garrick, Liliana potentially, Nissa. Like, there's definitely a Super Friend style deck there. And if any deck wants to play that new artifact Veil thing too, that would be it.
Okay.
I'm not saying he's a Jace the Mind Sculptor. What I will suggest is that he's the second Planeswalker ever to have four abilities.
And I mean, you almost would say he's on power level of Nicholas Bolas, but I think he definitely serves a role, and you see
I
maybe
think
two
of.
He's
weaker than Bolas, but yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
He's weaker, but he's going to play better decks because he's playing into greens, so you're going to play with the ramp strategy. And
right,
you got
exactly.
Red.
And those mana dorks attacking for six as tramplers is going to be pretty relevant.
Well, if you ultimate it, I assume you're going to win. But, like, you're totally right. Like, the turn four Nissa into the turn five Garrick is, like, definitely a thing, especially, like, you know, you consider post-rotation. You know, on the other hand, the danger inherent in playing those ramp decks that we've always had has been that you can draw you know, either all acceleration and no threats or all threats and no acceleration, and Thoughtseize only enhances that problem. So, you know, there's definitely some risk there.
To an extent, but there's also – I think there's a lot of support for it. There's cards that do –
Court of Calling.
Yeah, I mean, Court of Calling is huge. But there's also, like, a number of creatures that, you know, you want to ramp with but also serve into these other strategies. I mean, it's – like, you just said it yourself, you know, yeah, you're not going to ultimate Garrick or, in like, you know, unless you're winning. But that's not always true. The decks can just push out enough tokens that your opponent can't deal with your Planeswalkers unless they have something like a Hero's Downfall. And that's how you win, is you your little mana dorks that you drew, just because you can stall up the board with, you know, 3/3 tokens or whatever. I don't know if Nissa makes out. I guess she just makes lands into creatures. But either way, like, they have ways of protecting themselves. And it's not unlikely that, you know, your mana creatures are what win it for you in the end. Like, that's how Rock works. It's one of the few deck types, I think, where you really have to look at the ultimates as your win condition, because you're not usually playing a lot of creatures on top of these kinds of Planeswalkers. Like, right. I know I played a deck in Extended with Liliana Vest and the original Garrick, where I only had two creatures in the entire deck. My Planeswalkers were my win conditions. Because you can grind out games, and you just stall up the board so much to the point where, like, okay, even if the Hero's Downfall one of your Planeswalkers, you're so far ahead because you've just played bomb after bomb.
Okay, so I think it's fairly obvious that Garrick has got a lot going for him. I think casuals are really going to like him, and wanting to bust him in booster packs is going to sell a lot of booster packs. So core set typically doesn't sell as well, which can keep the price of the mythics pretty high, which is why you kind of want to trade for them aggressively, because the price is a little bit better insulated than in a set where the cards are going to sell a ton. But if Garrick has any applicability outside of casual formats, his price could really go nuts. So this is, it's really good to have a Chase Mythic like this in the core set, and, it's good to have more than just Garrick. So I think with so many Chase cards in the set, it could sell better than a typical core set. And that kind of brings me up, it brings me to a point I want to discuss, because I'm unsure about the future of the Painlands. So as you guys probably know, Sheevan Reef, Llanowar Waste, Caves of Koilos, you have My Coast, Battlefield Forge, the enemy-colored cycle of Apocalypse, Painlands, are all going to be in M15. Now this is going to help if we're correct about Khans of Tarkir being a wedge set. It's going to be good mana fixing. When we lose the Ravnica Shocklands at rotation when Khans comes in, this is probably going to help the Temple cycle with mana fixing. So what we've seen is Sheevan Reef was getting played in Storm, and that made it like a $9 card. All the others were like $2-3, you know, based, you know, EDH and that sort of thing. But Sheevan Reef was like $9 because it was played in Storm, and I don't think it was played enough to justify that. I think a lot of people just went and bought them up, and then it's everybody selling 3 copies on TCG Player. No one wants to lower their price. The stores aren't lowering their price because nobody else is. So they kind of stayed high. Now we've seen with the spoiling of them, Llanowar Waste is up to like $8. Can these maintain like the $8 that they're at right now?
So
with supply and demand,
is your question, can the original or even, you know, the 9th or 10th edition printings
I don't think it'll matter. I don't think, like, the apocalypse or, like, the white borders.
I mean, it does matter some just because people preference borders. But I think – I mean, I'm the one who made the buy call on this a few months ago, if I remember correctly. Not for this purpose. I just had said something about it for modern mostly.
Yeah,
obviously,
you
know, accidentally makes some money.
Yeah.
But this is definitely the sell point. I mean, they are good. But when you really think about it, they've been printed more times than the old core lands. And those weren't these prices when they were in standard. Like, these cards still aren't that hard to find. I find them all the times in collections. I actually just need to go gather the ones that I have right now and sell them this week because it's time to get out.
I think they're a sell too, but like, I don't know. I don't think they can maintain $8. Could they possibly? It's just.
Okay, so.
Finance has been so weird lately.
And some of the good ones may be $8, but I don't think it's gonna hold for most of them. There might be one or two that hit $8 at any one point in standard. And that's like assuming that there's like two or three different tier one decks that are playing a four.
But isn't $8 insane? Isn't that just nuts?
No, because you really think about it, like, even though there are just as many printings of it as there are these other core lands, most of them are pretty old. Even 10th edition, I believe, is the last, like, mass reprint of them, right?
Yes.
And you think about the amount of cards printed, it takes almost two sets back then to equal what a set is now, if not more.
Well, yeah, I agree with that. I think that if any are going to hold value, it would be the Apocalypse ones over the 9th or 10th edition ones. Because they're the original.
You mean like the Ice Age through...
No, the 9th and 10th edition ones will hold more value than these. The 9th and 10th edition ones will hold more value than the Apocalypse ones. It's border preference,
really?
People. That border. Yep. And it really is going to depend on how this new border takes and if the casual crowd and the people that are going to sustain this value down the road and, you know, the people who still need these lands for whatever purpose it may be, like this border over the 10th
edition. You're telling me people like... You can't lump 9th and 10th together.
One
is white-bordered and one isn't.
Ninth are white-borders, 10th are black-border.
Yeah, like you just lump those two together. It's not...
The 10th edition cards, most of the 9th edition stuff that's worth extra is the foils. The 10th edition is what matters. That's the border change.
And so you're saying that people like the 10th edition more than they like the Apocalypse?
Yeah.
Really? By how much?
I don't know about that.
By a lot. Go look at the prices of those cards. Well, I mean, you probably have to look at the old. Yeah, they've probably evened out.
Especially 10th edition was the set where you can get all 10 of them. You know, because like the Ice Age cycle, they had like a bunch of different arts, but like, I think, wasn't 10th edition, like, in a black border with all of them, with all 10 of them, with the X on them, I think the only way you can get all 10 of them is 10th edition. In a black border, unless you have them foil in an older set.
Yeah.
But then you just like your foils.
We'll see. We'll see, I suppose. I guess even the new ones.
Okay, so here's why I'm asking. These are in a core set.
What?
The core sets...
What?
What?
I was like literally like mid-sentence.
I couldn't hear that. The audio is shitty.
Couldn't hear that because you were talking.
I couldn't hear shit.
I believe you.
The audio's fucking up. Ryan's looking at his microphone. I can't hear shit.
Holy shit. Oh, man.
So
waste went from $2 to $9?
Yeah.
Yeah,
exactly.
They all spiked hard. So I would say even the new ones, I would not be surprised to see them hold at least $5. Because the M10 lands, which were in M10, M11, M12, M13, 4 years of them, they were hitting during the big, you know, player boom and Innistrad and going, you know, around that time, they were hitting $3 to $5 retail. So, you know, the number of printings is about equal. There's far fewer of these in circulation than there are those M10 lands. So I do not think $5 to $7 is unreasonable for these.
These are in a core set. So this is not going to inject as many copies. So if you look at, like, it's not fair to look at the price of the Shocklands, especially because the Shocklands are fetchable with fetches and, you know, played in modern, blah, blah, blah. It's not fair to look at the price, but I think we could look at the trajectory just to see what the effect of being legal and standard would have on a cycle of lands. And, like, we had those cards in the Ravnica sets, spread out all 10 of them over the booster packs, and then they were in the Dragon's Maze packs to give people another crack at them, and that was when they finally went below 10 bucks. So these are going to be in a core set that's not going to get drafted as much, it's not going to get opened as much. Is that going to attenuate the increased supply, and therefore an increased demand will have a more significant effect on price than print if these had been printed in Khans of Tarkir? That's kind of what I want to know.
So your question is, is your question that more will be open because this is going to be a popular core set, or that there will be fewer because it's still a core set?
It's still a core set.
Okay, so I agree with you. And I'd say that's...
Like, I'm having a really hard... This is really messing me up because, like, there's nothing historical I can look at because everything that I want to look at as a corollary, I disqualify for some reason or another.
So they're definitely...
These are really
going
juking
to be,
me out.
They're definitely going to be higher than they would be, but at the same time, I think because of how much value is overall in the set, and it's not like these are one of the, oh man, I'm so stoked that these are back kind of cards, I don't think that the price is going to be as high as you would want it to be. Like, I really feel like because the set overall carries a lot of value, like, because of Redemption, you know, we've talked about this multiple times, Redemption, along with a number of other factors, just, you know, busting open enough packs at one time, you're going to open enough of these all good cards that a set only has so much money it can carry. And if it, you know, if it's like Dragon's Maze where you have the voice, obviously, like, you're carrying it all in one card, all your other cards are going to be worth nothing. But here, there's so many cards that are good that none of them, I think, can be a ton, and especially in the rares. I mean, look at things like Urborg and stuff like that. Those are still going to be in demand.
God, I forgot about Urborg.
Those cards, there's so many rares in the set that are just good, and that's really going to hurt the overall price of all of the rares. And even though there's going to be less of them, and the demand will certainly be there, there's a demand for the set overall, which means that you're going to be, I mean, selling everything rather than just selling the few key cards.
Right, and that is a really good point. And it applies while the set is in print. You know, that's why, like I said, I really want these in 2 years, but you're right. While it's in print, it can only hold so much value. And these could, you know, you're right. I guess I could see these taking the hit. Especially, you know, this is the point on these I'm really interested in. They've talked numerous times about how they want all the mana in standard, to be balanced between enemy colored and allied colors. So that's why you have all 10, Shocklands. You have all 10 Scrylands. Now they're unbalancing this by giving us 5 enemy colored lands. I think that certainly leaves the door wide open for a popular cycle of allied colored lands coming in Khans of Tarkir, which, as people have speculated, is a wedge set. Fetch lands?
I think in fetch lands I want to, but I don't. I think probably filter lands are more likely, but then again, why not do the whole thing? I think fetch lands is your best bet, but I don't think it's a wedge set because they have talked about having problems with having multicolored sets, gold sets too close to each other.
And they talked about not reprinting pain lands in core set too.
They said that. Plus, these pain lands are not fetchable with fetches. Mm-hmm. So that's
I mean,
that's
fairly relevant.
Another thing, like, if we did get the fetches, these would be good lands to go along with them because you can't abuse it that way.
Or
and then you've got the temples and you've got these.
Or maybe they might have that the enemy colors are the focus of the next set, and that they got a lot of two-color pairs that are a lot of enemy.
But they aren't balancing the mana at that point, right? Like, that's the biggest red flag, I guess, to me, is the talk about – so what, are we going to get a site – if they want the mana in block to be balanced, are they going to give us – and they're like, when you're doing fetch lands, you can get away with it being a little unbalanced just because of the way they work. But if you're trying to do a different cycle, are they going to give us, you know, 10 new lands and then we just randomly have an extra 5 for enemy colors?
Yes, like, I think that's what's going to happen. I think they're not going to make that's what they're going to do. It's going to be a focus on the enemy colors. That's why. Because that's going to be the stronger color combination.
But isn't Sarkhan Vol like the marquee guy in Khans of Tarkir? And he's only been printed as a red-green or a red-black guy. And those are both alike. Friendly color combinations. I'm not saying like Sarkhan Vol being a red green guy and Shards of Alara completely invalidates it being an enemy colored set. I'm just saying that just seems odd.
But I mean,
also there's also the point that if they want the set to be all about enemy colors, then you're going to have a block pro tour without your marquee enemy colored lands.
Well, no, you would have your enemy colored lands in the beginning of the set. It would unbalance the color, sure, but over time it would balance out.
Well, they're already unbalanced because of these pain lands that aren't going to be in block.
And this,
yeah, Corbin's saying like you wouldn't want to block PT saying, oh, well, we don't have access to those enemy colored pain lands, but we've got no, I don't know.
No, what I'm saying, like, what I'm saying is in the first set of the, how that would work best is in the first set of the new block is that you would have the enemy lands as well. So you would have such of a tie, the good mana and going into the enemy colors that people would be forced into playing those colors.
So you think they're going to have a cycle of enemy colored lands in Khans of Tarkir with an enemy colored cycle in M15, and we're going to have 10 more enemy colored lands than ally colored lands?
I think that would make more sense than them doing ally colored lands.
I don't think that makes sense at all.
I'm with Jason. That makes no sense.
Well, like, it doesn't matter. We're just speculating.
Oh, but it's fun.
Like, baselessly. And I think, let's talk actionables, okay?
All right.
Let's give people a few bullet points actionable about these pain lands. What should people be doing now that the ship has sailed and they're all like $8 now?
Sell.
Except for Shivan Reef, which went from 9 to 10, because why not?
Sell.
Sell.
You can probably find these in buck binders, which was what Ryan and I were saying to do for, you know, a while now. You have them at Coast and Line of War Wastes look really good at a buck or two when Shivan Reef hit 8.
Yeah.
So if you got these, I'd ship them. Because I don't think you're ever going to be glad that you bought them at only $8.
So yeah, I agree with that. As far as actionables go, you know, I will just throw this piece of information out there. At Grand Prix Washington, D.C. last weekend, dealers were petrified to touch allied colored fetch lands. Nobody wanted to buy them. Buy lists on them had dropped. So, you know, I'm not saying that means anything, because all that it means is that dealers are concerned about it. But as far as actionables go, if you have those and you are worried about a reprint, it's only going to get that effect is only going to become more pronounced until the lands for the fall set are spoiled.
So what do you guys think about Jace the Living Turd?
So Jace the Living Guild Pact, as the card actually reads, is two colorless, two blue, starts with 5 loyalty, +1, look at the top 2 cards of your library, put one of them in your graveyard. -3, return another target non-land permanent to its owner's hand. -8, each player shuffles his or her hand and graveyard into their library, and you draw 7 cards.
I like this card, and no one else does, and
Marcel,
no one else likes the other Jace, and I like that Jace.
What? What do you mean? We all
like
that Jace.
They're not going to fuck up their poster, boy. It's not going to happen. This is good. We might not see it yet. There will be some sort of reanimator strategy or graveyard strategy, threshold, something like that.
Oh, my God. I was with you until you said that.
This card will be good. This card, I'm sorry.
It'll see play because it's Jace and because we're losing the other Jace and because he, like, has pseudo card draw and he's got, you know, a pseudo bounce ability and his ultimate wins the game. It's a Jace. Like, other Planeswalkers will have to protect him, but that's always been the case. Except
you don't even have
Architect
to as much, though. Like, he starts with 6 loyalty.
Yeah.
Like, that card protects itself.
So, okay, so I have 2 points to make, and then we'll look at Marcel's counter argument. The first one is that Ryan is right that the other Jace was underappreciated by a lot of people until rotation, and then it became extremely powerful. The second point, also they touched on, is 6 loyalty is a lot. And coming down on turn 4, or earlier if you're like blue, green, whatever, and having the ability to bounce something and still have 2 left over, is not insignificant, even if the plus ability itself maybe isn't insane. But okay, so I think it will be played, but not crazy good. Marcel, what are your thoughts?
I think it'll be played. I think they're not going to fuck up on Jace. I'm scared of that. The only way that it'll be played heavily is if there is, again, a reanimation or something to deal with the graveyard. And the way that they're setting up the set, it just seems like that's very likely. I think that's going to happen. But even so, though, I mean, I just think, like, sure, 6 loyalty does in a way protect itself. So the Jace is not just weak, but at the same time, the top 2 cards, if it's not a graveyard or if you're not really doing much, that's sure you think you're drawing a card, but you're really not, and you're shipping a card down. There's pseudo. This is worse than Scry in terms of card advantage. And then 3 to bounce is just, I think that's just way too hefty.
Well, I can bounce another planeswalker.
Yeah, it's not just a creature. It's a permanent. It doesn't even say non-land permanent. It says non-land permanent.
Yeah.
It's, what am I talking about?
I can't bounce lands. That's not okay.
I think the odds, like, when you were playing with Jace, the odds of you really wanted to bounce something else are there, but they're more fringed. More likely than not, you want to get rid of a creature and risking of getting rid of Jace. I don't see that occurring. And I think he's like a Gideon. Like, you know, like Gideon just didn't see play, didn't really go anywhere, didn't really do anything. And I think maybe eventually you might see Jace maybe at the next set or something. I don't know. But I don't think he's going to be making until we see like major graveyard thing coming out of the next set. Yeah, I don't see it happening.
So I do think you bring a good point, because the argument, I guess, is, you know, on one side, the argument is, you know, they may only have one creature when you play this guy on turn four and you get to bounce him. And that's like protecting your Jace. That's really good. The counter argument to that is, having an active Jace doesn't do that much, and you're right about that. You know, protecting Architect of Thought was just insane because it gave you so many cards. Protecting this, you're right, it doesn't do much. Like, it's not drawing a card. It's not even scrying. In fact, sometimes, sure, it's good. Sometimes it does nothing. Like, it actually strikes me as a planeswalker that can somewhat be ignored. You know, that said, if you can – you know, somehow get it down on the field and protect it for two turns, that ultimate is insane. But yeah, I mean, I see both sides of it. It just kind of depends, I think, on how fast the format is when it shakes out.
I guess he's okay with scry also.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, he does work with that, but I think the value of him is his ultimate. Honestly, that's the only value that he has, is because you tick towards that pretty soon. And if you do, you have a way to gum up the board, but
yeah,
you tick up by drawing cards. Very good.
Not trying cards.
I just don't. I can't have anyone tell me where's the deck that he's going to come in. Sure, we don't have all the cards, but can you fit him into an existing deck right now as it is right now being played?
I'm more interested in post rotation since it's 3 months away.
Well, yeah, but
know,
I mean,
four
even
months, but
even say Jace Architect Bot wasn't here, where would he fit in?
Nowhere right now.
Yeah, but
I like him in a deck that's going to, like you said, Reanimator. Like, I like the new Convoke Reanimation spell. Like, I think there's going to be something there.
Yeah, but I hate speculating on cards that might be something based on something that may never come. Yeah. I've been down that path
those
before.
Those are the cards that you really hit a home run with. It's not the cards that everybody thinks are good that, you know, drop by a dollar or two from their presale price that you make money on. It's these cards like Jace where if it drops to a $3 mythic, fuck, take a chance on it.
Yeah, I would say that. I'd say nothing wrong with that. Even four to five. I don't see
that. This will never be too cheap. It'll be too expensive.
It's a Jace. Yeah.
But I mean, I'm saying don't dismiss it, because I'm pretty sure they're not going to mess up their poster boy. Like, this card has more utility than we're seeing right now.
I think they need to temper. They need to temper blue a little bit. That's all.
I mean, I wouldn't be surprised after all the Jace mistakes. They said, "Hey, we want another memory adept, and that it's, you know, can be good, but isn't metagame defining." So I can see them powering it.
You guys don't consider card selection like that pseudo card draw. Isn't scrying 2 worth like drawing a card?
Yeah, but this isn't scry 2. Like, this is not scrying, not even a little. Yeah.
No. Drawing or scrying is it's drawing a half a card. This is drawing slightly less than half a card.
Yeah,
it's like a quarter.
Yeah, I guess it just
there are advantages.
It clears through bricks on top, which is scry can do also. So I don't know.
And the difference between this and scry is, like, if this said scry 1, would people like it?
Yes, I would. I would totally
So if it says Scry 1, so think about it this way. Like, that's what I'm saying with the graveyard theme or whatever it may be. If there's anything there, this Jace suddenly becomes better than if it said Scry 1.
Yes, that's exactly what I'm saying.
That's the way you have to look at this, is like, if there is something that makes this real, this Jace is actually very powerful.
If binning it is better than putting it on the bottom of your library, I agree with that, I guess. It sounded ridiculous when you first said it, though.
Well, I don't know that we're going to see any particular reanimation theme pushed in Constructs here. There's already reanimation cards.
One or two pieces.
Reanimation cards. It's already a deck, right?
Right.
So, like, look at it slotting into there. That's what I think those pieces are already there. We have the reanimation spells. This is an enabler for it. So it's worth testing whether or not it's good in that deck.
Exactly. All right. So anyway, picks of the week.
Picks of the week.
So let's see. Let me start this one off. I'm going to say some Vintage Masters. I'll say get your Vintage Masters now, because I believe by the time this comes out, they're going to be done with the drafts and cards are going to slowly tick up. So you see your cards that you want to get, or you see your decks or dual lands, get your dual lands because they're insanely cheap right now. They're only going to go up. But one card I think is a good pick is Ikarid. This is a everyone knows about this card, but if you don't know what this card is, it's a major player in the Dredge deck. It's going to be played as a 4-of. It's $2 right now in the Vintage Masters Edition, and you could get the Torment Edition for $6.66. I mean, $6.66, which is very weird. but yeah, so this card is played as a 4-of. It's pretty used in Legacy and Vintage Dredge. So it's going to be played there. And at $2, it was at $20 in Torment before Vintage Masters came out. So there's a lot of room for that to get back up closer, at least to 4 or 5. I could even see 6 down the line. So I think this is definitely a good long-term sit on this card, wait a year, see what happens. But you cannot lose on this card. So go ahead and get some.
Okay. I guess I'll go next since mine's actually also on Magic Online, also to do with Vintage Masters. I was going to say something. I guess you kind of covered it. But really all of the cheap cards right now, like I went through, I think it was yesterday, the day before, and went through and just bought my playset of things like Berserk for a quarter. I mean, there's no reason not to. These cards, they're not necessarily the, you know, going to be played as in all the tier one decks, but these cards are going to go up over time. And the ones that, you know, you see their old prices and they haven't moved nearly as much as you would think they would comparatively to the Vintage Masters version. A lot of times they're 10 times as much as the Vintage Masters copy. And those copies are only going to go up over time. And the next time they reprint them, the same thing will happen. The Vintage Masters copies won't drop nearly as much as what the new copies will come in as. So even with the, you know, the chance of all the reprints, I think you're very safe in picking up any of the cheap cards now under the assumption that, you know, down the road that will still be a $2-3 Berserk if there's any decks that actually support it. And I think if you just kind of pick up everything that could be played, enough of them will be played that you will do well.
Another way, Ancient Tomb is $2.50. Like, yeah.
Yeah, I'm all about that. I picked up a bunch of stuff this week. Me and my friend are kind of combining so we can build like an entire Legacy collection. And he's picking up like all the duels and stuff. And I picked up a lot of stuff. And it's also important to note the cards that, like, I guess a good one was Chrome Mox. When I heard that Cruel Bargain was going to be in Vintage Masters, I went and bought the rest of Spanish Inquisition since I could finally build that online. I picked up my Chrome Moxes. I don't remember what they were, but I think they were 6 or 7 a piece, something like that. And now they're over 15. And there's a lot of these cards that weren't necessarily like important before, but now that Legacy and Vintage are becoming more of a thing, there's these cards everyone's forgetting about that are already in existence and weren't just in Vintage Masters that have skyrocketed. And if you see or think of anything like that that's still already low, it's going to be a lot like what happened with Modern in real life, where some of these decks that aren't really thought about right away, once they become viable strategies online and there's actually a metagame forming and stuff, you'll see a lot of these cards double, triple in price just because, yeah, they're still available and they will be reprinted at some point, but they're currently still hard to find. Infernal Tutor is another good example. I guess I have to pay 25 ticks a piece for those, which is insane.
Yeah, this card just shot up. It's partially due to Modern and that Death Shadows deck that's made a new re-comeback. Oh, man. I can't believe that card is still making an impact.
I'm so happy. Like, so happy, because, I mean, that's like the longest running troll ever. I don't know what I did. I did not intend for that card to do anything at all, ever, outside of the one standard deck that was terrible that I built with it. And yet, here it is, still kicking, like, years later.
Okay. So I noticed something really weird. Copy Artifact from Revised is like $5. I mean, it's been printed 4 times, so, but it gets used a lot in EDH. So this is like a $500 alpha card that's $5 in Revised. And I noticed that Fork was a pretty good corollary because Fork from Revised is also $5. But if you look at the unlimited Fork, that's $15.20. And the unlimited Copy Artifact is like $8 to $10. So I think the fact that Copy Artifact is less iconic than Fork, but it gets played way, way more because of EDH. And I think people are tinkering with it in Legacy, but like Transmute Artifact and Tezzeret, you know, all that kind of stuff's way better. But Copy Artifact, I think, it's a little cheaper than it should be right now. I don't think a Revised should be as much as a Fork, or as much as a Revised Fork, and I don't think the Unlimited should be less than the Unlimited Fork. I think there's growth potential on both Unlimited and Revised Copy Artifact. So that's a card that's been trending up slightly, but it's so good in EDH that I really think that's a That's like, that's not a card I want to look at in 3 months and be like, ah, it's a miss, it didn't go up. This is long term, but like, you can get them for $5, so I would trade for every copy artifact I see. You're not going to see a ton of these in binders, but EDH players are buying these on TCG Player, and, you know, if it ends up in a binder, I'd go after them. And I think I might, when I want to buy in for these for cash, I'll let everyone know when I'm doing that. But for right now, these aren't a cash buy, but like, I don't know, maybe buy a playset for $20. Like, what's $20? So that's something to think about. I really think that there's growth potential on copy artifact, and especially because the unlimited copy is $5 cheaper than I think it should be right now. So there's built-in growth potential right there, just catching up to Fork. So that's my pick of the week.
Okay. I'm going to put a sell call out this week. Corsair Crucifix. It's one I think the last time maybe we did this even, I don't remember exactly, but I think we said to watch it because it had spiked so high and see kind of where things shift. Since then, there was a major development in that arena, and that was the spoiling Reclamation Sage in M13. It's just a 3-mana green 2/1. When it comes into play, destroy target artifact or enchantment. That's creature removal on a body in standard right now. That kills a whole lot of creatures, including Corsair of Crucifix, which I think has the most room to fall of all the things that this would impact. You know, it also is something that, you know, hits your Herald of Torment. It hits a lot of things, actually, in that blue-black deck, or that mono-black deck, rather, coming out of block. But I think Corsair has the most room to fall. You know, look at Boros Reckoner. And I know we've used that comparison before. And while I do think Boros Reckoner was maybe more of a flash in the pan than Corsair was, just simply because of the harsh mana requirements on it, the fact is that it was correct to get out of it when it spiked, because it just couldn't hold it. And I think the same thing is going to be true with Corsair. You know, it spiked. It's now more or less holding steady at that price. But now we have a easily playable green card that is a removal spell on a body. So I think that hurts Corsair more than anything else. So I am ready to get rid of mine.
I do agree. I think you should probably sell them, but I wouldn't necessarily fire sell them, because I think just as many people who are going to be adopting this new 2/1 to destroy things are also going to be, you know, they're like we were talking about the potential like rock style ramp decks or whatever for whether it be Nissa or Garrick or, you know, some combination of these cards. I think there's going to be a lot more options for Corsair to be played in as well. So
I do agree with you. Yeah, I think that the price of it is going to go down rather than up from here, and I think it's going to do so in the next 6 months.
I
agree. I don't think you fire sale.
Like fire sale them. I think you try and trade them out if you can, honestly. I think this is kind of the perfect example of a time when, because you don't just want to take that heavy percentage and you don't have to sell them tomorrow because, you know, something's getting printed or they're getting reprinted, I think this is a good time to, like, push those out, do it in trade, because they're definitely still in demand.
Right. Yeah, I agree.
Anyone?
So is that
else?
A wrap? Oh, it looks like we're out of here. This is the end of the episode.
Oh, don't we have a shout-out?
We have a shout-out.
Brainstorm Breweries managing editor, Danny Brown, his wife, I guess, did all the work here. She gave birth, I think, Wednesday night or Thursday morning. Hope I got that time right. Congratulations to Danny. He's probably going to need some help with his editing duties on the site, but I'm more than happy to help out with that. Congratulations to the Brown family that just got bigger by 50%.
Yeah. Woo. Claps. Congratulations, guys.
Yeah, Danny. Congratulations. Yeah, he is one of the most hardworking people behind the scenes, and most people don't give him enough
He's
credit for
probably it. The most underpaid editor in Magic the Gathering.
I think so. It's not at our own faults, really. It really is not.
We will work on that. Thank you for all you do, Danny, and you can definitely have the week off.
from us, I think you're going to be pretty busy this week, though.
We'll crack the whip on him next week. So that's our shout-out. We normally don't do that, but that seemed worth it.
All right. So let's get out of here. And check us out next week. This is Brainstorm Brewery. Adios, muchachos.
Adios.
Brainstorm Brewery is brought to you by GatheringMagic.com and CoolStuffInc.com. Show your support.
like how Ryan said the same thing that Marcel did.
Yeah, why not?
Like he's behind him, like say, the bullying karate kid, like, get him a body bag! Yeah, adios! LaRusso! We'll see you at the All-Valley Karate Tournament!